Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are cleaning up public discourse because it's filthy. It's gotten all polluted and problematic as if it was ever anything different. But we're trying to make it a little bit safer to go back into the linguistic waters here. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. And the podcast, I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. That's one thing. I also try to convert conservatives because they worry me. I think they are not really on the Democratic rails these days. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. Today's another episode of the rhetorician interviews with Dr. David Payne. This is like our, I don't know, probably up to 20.
Maybe somewhere. 15 anyway.
15, and then we've got some that are in the can that are going to be a special product.
There you go.
We haven't released it all yet, so look forward to that massive, you know, economic juggernaut.
The package.
The package. Today is March 1st, 2022, and we're watching war on all our devices. So I thought today we would talk about rhetoric and war. Those have always gone together, right?
Sure.
Precursor to war, during war, after war.
Substitute for war. Yeah.
Substitute verbal war.
Right. And then there's the war of the words.
There's a core metaphor, you know, base metaphor in rhetoric of war, right?
Yeah, this is one of these extraneous factoids that it has been said that basically Aristotle's concept of rhetoric was militaristic, that these were warring factions. And then the theories we identify in the 20th century called the new rhetorics are peace. They're about cooperation, about keeping society packaged together. So instead of the polemics of, you know, of contest, they're ironic, they're peaceful.
Yeah, and that's
a useful little fact that one might want to know if they had a PhD in this stuff.
Right. And it's an interesting place to start because I talked to Bill Keith on here not long ago. I don't know if you checked me that out, but he just came out with a book on civility, you know, the whole history of civil tradition in rhetoric. And
timely.
What's that?
Timely.
And we talked about it quite a bit. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm not sure that has the resonance, right, that it had. Like, we did all the de Tocqueville stuff and talked about some of that sort of early, you know, hyper-community, hyper-small, you know, political work that people had to do. And it doesn't really seem to be working that way right now.
Right. Well, I mean, still the thrust of the return to rhetoric in the 20th century with all of the strife of the 20th century, you know, the urge to ask how does, you know, language induce cooperation? How does it fix problems? How does it remedy misunderstanding? You know, think about Burke's line that rhetoric deals with the state of Babel after the fall, when we're all speaking different languages. And, that's a pretty apt metaphor for my reading of the last 72 hours of TV. There's a lot of different audiences purposes. Some have dubbed this as clearly an information war. Who's winning? And so that the spin seems to be, you know, kind of where the game is, or at least in a way, we hope that's where the game is. Because when the bottom falls out of that, that's when the rockets start shooting. And we're kind of, everybody's saying, yeah, this is going to be happening now because Putin is losing the symbolic war, the war of PR, the war of information.
Which has always been his thing, right? I mean, all the way from the KGB, you know, the PSYOPs, undermining of other cultures through their public discourse channels. That's always been his thing. So if they're taking that away, he just keeps ratcheting it up, right? The only thing you can ratchet up now is like they're talking about him using thermobaric bombs, which are essentially nuclear and things like that. So you go, like, when all the discourse fails, you saw Trump kind of do this too. When all the authoritarian discourse masquerade fails, they start turning back to actual violence.
Well, that's the fear, sure. Certainly that's what Putin has got us thinking, is that if we don't, you know, and it's really interesting that if we don't find a way for him to be able to seize however preposterous a narrative of victory here, or at least, you know, face-saving victory, that is going to do nothing but get worse. So
you're now the czar of rhetoric for America and the world for this war. Lay out some things that are useful for people here to get a handle on this, because it's coming from so many channels now. Some of it's filtered through the media, some of it's being filtered through social media, which is again filtered through some other institutions. Some of it's coming clean through people with phones. What does rhetoric do with all this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what is the goal? Does one want to be able to seize the truth from what's going on, or pick which side to get on? Or, I mean, in a way, the at least from my vantage point, the and here's, I guess, the warning on that. It seems like we're winning, you know, the day here, that Zelensky is a fabulous hero, that liberal democracy is being redeemed in the face of worldwide authoritarian tendencies. The world is coming together. America's coming together. The Republicans are having to choose to stand up or not. So that there's a kind of a sorting in our own conflicts. So there's a lot of positive synergy being generated. And I wouldn't necessarily want to deconstruct that, although my tendencies are to try to ask, some people are making those messages and we're all, you know, it's like cheering for your own team. How is this playing elsewhere? And how does one caution about, you know, so I don't want to call that disinformation, yet at the same time, we can't completely say we're not being subjected to our own propaganda about this. And maybe somewhere, somehow, somebody needs to look at the other side, how this is playing elsewhere. Because I think strategically one needs to sort some of this out. So is that what an average consumer needs to do? Is that what your QAnon fan needs to do? I don't know, so I guess rhetoric to me would be to try to come to the best estimate of what is really going on and how better to exercise it toward the greater good, whatever that may be.
Well, there's the rub, right? That final toward the greater good. So if rhetoric has a journalistic truth, you know, adherence, which has nothing to do with humanity or the people involved, and it's like, I just want to know, you know, a good, clean understanding of the rhetoric that's occurring in this whole panorama and the entire ecology, versus like what you're saying, like as soon as you're a rhetorician, you're like, well, if I'm taking apart the positive propaganda that's coming to us, that's bolstering us and allowing us to sort of marshal resources and not fall down into the cynicism of, oh my God, we're being dragged into the third world war again. What is the role of the rhetorician then? Like, do we have that moral dictate to be like, well, you know, just don't look quite through the blinders?
I guess it depends on your position here. I mean, If you're Putin's Machiavelli, advising the prince there, somebody needs to find a kind of a way to gently put in his ear that, you know, the bubble that he's living in is not, probably, you know, that he really doesn't want to kill a lot of people. And to some extent has not yet. I mean, because part of what I'm seeing on our side is all the war footage, the smoke, the rockets in the building. They'll show the same rocket sticking out of a floor 400 times. And a tremendous amount. This is one thing that the Ukrainians are being given so much credit for. They are producing a tremendous amount of narrative content. The Russian soldiers weeping, saying, "I didn't want to do this." The mothers and their sons, the speeches of Zelensky himself. I mean, it's really quite an. And I've heard this yet, you know, today. Boy, they are really winning the information war here. And we are loving that. Yet at the same time, we've had a war going on for 6 days and only like 400 Ukrainians have been killed. They said something like 400 rockets have been shot off. Well, you know, when we attacked Iraq, I think we probably shot that many the first day into one city, right?
Yeah, I mean.
So clearly this has not yet been all out war, but that is kind of the way that we are. You know, this is the horror, this is the tragedy, and not to discount that, except to say, you know, when we say we're winning this, so that commentary does always come with that caution that, you know, that the Russian army is capable of unspeakable horrors, or that we are being fed the narrative of how incompetent the generals are, that, you know, here's this convoy out of gas and they didn't bring along any food. So we're feeling really good about our team. And I don't know, I guess my instincts just say, well, what are the other explanations for this? One of which occurs to me is they probably didn't tell the generals what they were going to be doing. It doesn't take much of a general to know if you're going to invade a country, you need gas and food. And they, for them not to have it makes me suspicious. That,
right.
You know, maybe Putin just sort of decided at the last minute, well, let's, you know, they're making fun of me over there, let's go in. Whatever, I don't know the real answer, but I guess I'm just speaking as somebody whose rhetorical instincts are perhaps developed, that I would want to listen to and consider what is the possible other explanation for this. And once again, to realize that we are also being insulated from certain kinds of messages that we get some kinds of echoes on, and these have an agenda too. Oh, Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump are the most popular people on Russian TV right now. Anyway,
it is babble on top of babble on top of babble, right?
It is the conditions of babble, right?
That the hyper reality of babble that you just can't track. This amount of messages coming this fast and this, you know, from these many sources, rhetoric just breaks because you got to slow down enough to kind of apply some of the concepts. You know, even this idea of wanting accurate narratives so that you can make some decisions about what's really happening, and this idea of truth in war, I mean, that's a horrible thing to try to hold war to. War is built on falsity. Like on both sides,
it takes the old saw that the first victim in a war is truth, right? And then complexifies that by all the cell phones, right, operating in this environment, all the different media outlets, it's interesting because but the response to all of a sudden start removing these agencies from Facebook finally which if nothing else isolates and maybe simplifies some of this. That could be dangerous too, you know, and we don't know what the consequences of that are, because, you know, one thing could be true is that, you know, the rhetoric precedes the war.
Right.
We get sold the idea of it as, you know, if you just think back around to the, you know, the first Gulf War, I remember that far back anyway. Sort of like, you know, the senior Bush president says, You know, we're drawing a line in the sand 6 months from now. If you're not out here in six, so they had like 6 months to create this narrative of Saddam Hussein as Hitler, and this is the most tremendous. This is all happening in the space of 24 hours. You know, that was a war that made CNN, you know, made cable news network what it is.
Right.
So anyway, you're right. It was refracted through a dozen different lenses right now.
It probably is what it feels like in some ways to be in this sort of super contentious verbal war, that you don't know where your enemies are coming from and they just pop up out of nowhere. I've been following a lot of this on Twitter, and Twitter's now feeding me more Ukrainians, you know, writing about their experience. So it's not a bunch of visuals. It's a lot of actual short version, you know, text, and, you know, some of its paragraphs and threads, but sort of describing what's happening. And I think it has more texture, more probably, you know, it's a little more widespread than the visuals that are breaking through. But it is still this sense of, I don't even know if these people are real. You know, they've got Ukrainian names, but you know,
they could all be puppets, right?
So easy to fake. Hmm. So there's that sense of, you know, again, so much of war, the physical war versus what's becoming the rhetorical war, right? They feed each other. This idea of disguising, you know, and surprising the enemy, and always, you know, avoiding their reconnaissance so that they don't know what you're doing. And over here in the rhetorical war, I've seen this sort of let up for a while, you know, because we've been dealing with Trump for so long and his Russianness. And we never could bring those things together enough for a big segment of the population to reach critical truth mass, where people are like, oh yeah, that guy's definitely a Russian agent. You know, and you see things like now, like Biden, I saw a story last week that Biden now has access to the recordings of Trump's meetings with Putin.
Oh, really? See, I wondered about that. I thought those have to exist, and wouldn't now be a good time to release them?
And you got to wonder, like, well, what is it? What's the play here rhetorically for Biden for not doing that? If it's smoking gun proof, that just ends the whole Trump phenomenon forever, right?
Well, it depends on what's on them, I suppose. What we suspect is true. I guess the other, you know, but once again, they have a certain percentage of the population prepared to disregard as fake anything that they might have. Maybe if the translator were to swear an oath, but even then, he would probably be pilloried by the opposition. You know, and once again, I project that into what's probably going on around Putin right now, that, you know, for at least by all the experts that I see, the parade of them in the last week, they're all saying that that's basically, you know, his world too, that he's surrounded with yes men, and that he's got a loyal cadre that, you know, that the truth has never mattered there at all. But, you know, and from the things that they've quoted him saying, clearly it doesn't. You know, that may be a long-term narrative and bias that they've created in me, but
it seems
plausible to me.
Right. So let's just use a rhetoric concept here to maybe add some illumination for what rhetoric, an academic approach to rhetoric, can actually possibly help with this massive, you know, world of babble. Just take the narrativity of it, right? So there are sort of four main character slots, it seems to me, that are operating here. There's hero, there's villain, there's victim, and then there's sort of hidden cause agents. And if we just use those as categories to sort of, let's get some control over what's happening here. Clearly, Zelensky, who is this non-entity for America, we had a tiny little blip of exposure because of Trump's phone call, but nobody did any research or learned anything about him, and suddenly has just projected up into this massive hero category.
Right.
Through what, 10, 12 speeches, something like that, and some photo ops, right? And so Putin, like today, Macron came out from France, and there were the quote they pulled out of his 4-hour meeting with Putin yesterday or the last few days was that he seems paranoid. He seems different now. So that starts to put Putin into this, not just authoritarian, but that late stage authoritarian whose mind is starting to crumble.
The madman, yes.
He's getting paranoid.
Yeah, the madman narrative here.
Yeah. And so that kind of villain who has nuclear weapons, that's something to super fear.
Right.
Right. So we've got that. And what you said at the beginning,
Ukrainians
aren't. I was going to say, Ukrainians aren't victim. They're not victim enough yet because only 400 of them have died. So we got to raid that.
Well, that may well happen. That's what one fears. Although, once again, I mean, that's just something I noticed that isn't really part of the narrative. I mean, this is horrific enough, especially with the pictures of smoke coming out of apartment buildings and the crying people and things like that. They're doing a good enough job, but for whom, I guess, is the, what are the possible outcomes here, I guess? And if you think just on either side, well, what is it that, you know, clearly Zelensky is trying to, you know, in a speech to the European Union yesterday, sort of say, hey, we're doing this. We are standing up not just for ourselves, but for all of democracy. And you need to get on board of this and send help. That's his job. And a lot of Americans, and this is also being narrated, are saying, you know, we look at that convoy sitting there and go, oh, a couple of airplanes could be very useful here. You know, why can't we do that? And some of the European countries that don't necessarily have the same political or policy restrictions that we do, maybe. So, you know, there is a powder keg there that could ignite that direction. At the same time, you consider, well, how does this end on the other side? How do you get, you know, what are the possible exit ramps for Putin? And how does that, well, you know, being displaced as a leader who screwed up is maybe the best outcome that could, you know, for all of us. Right.
That's what's being peddled right now, for sure.
Well, certainly the West is trying to fan that narrative.
Well, and Biden started with that, right? We're not looking to, you know, disrupt Russian society. We're not looking to pull down your entire. And in some ways, he introduced that possibility by saying, you know, by denying it, right? We're not looking to destabilize Russia. Well, maybe you are.
You know, I mean, if you think about the parallel where, you know, they showed us all these, you know, Russians in line with their cell phones won't work, their Apple Pay won't work, and they can't get money out of their ATM. This is an interesting picture. You know, these are not, you know, bedraggled, overweight peasants in a bread line that of some classic. These are middle class people, like, you know, if you think about what all of a sudden in America, if we couldn't get our money. You know, yeah, we're about to go nuts because we have some abstract figure called inflation that, oh my God, you mean there isn't free money available any longer? Yeah, and you know, that was another little factoid being bandied about, was that 50% of Americans think we are in a recession or a depression. Why? That's, you know, because of concerns over inflation or because, you know, what? Anyway.
Well, I think it's again,
talking about the truth and it's, you know, the narrative, and we don't know the narratives that are weaving that anxiety. At least I don't watch those sources. So.
Right. Well, and I think like when you talked about basically a consumption victim, like the revolution of the consumptionists, like if you take away the digital and you take away the cable and you take away their ability to shop, is that enough to destabilize a culture to where they'll overthrow a leader? And it's a brand new idea in some ways, like it goes back to bread lines, but this is now like cell phone lines, like everybody in line at the cell phone store.
I don't know if it's enough to destabilize Russia. Clearly it's not enough to bother Ukraine. I think it might wreak havoc in America. I guess my answer is if that happened to us,
we
might want to declare war.
I got interested a while back on Instagram in Russians who do Instagram, because it's verbal, so there's no translation. But watching to see how much of the things that they do are sort of common to the way the West does Instagram. And I probably follow, 25, 30 different Russians. And a lot of times it's, the influencers in Russia, they're clearly selling things the same way like the American influencers do. And the aesthetics are very similar. And I'm surprised at how much of that stuff has, been imported into Russia, because those aren't images you ever see about Russia. So it does have that, sort of that layer of the middle class, like you're saying, that you really mess with your middle class, you are messing with your base.
Well, I think to a great extent, what the our experts are telling us is that this really won't end in Russia because of the popular revolt, because that this has to end with the upper crust. This has to be the oligarchs that sort of say, hey, I want my girlfriend back, I want my yacht back. That was the advice on One Morning Show, is don't just take their money and take their yacht, you must deport their girlfriend.
That's great, yeah.
These are the things most valuable to them. But whether or not, we talk about that we don't know what the counter narrative is, and we only get hints, once again, that little factoids that are out there that Putin enjoys, great popularity among the people, but much higher percentages than our presidents have for some time, in the 60s and 70%. There is this narrative that, the logic of his pushing this conflict goes back to the history of NATO encroaching and threatening and positioning nuclear weapons in Europe. We're being told that that's just their propaganda, right? But are the middle class Russians who are now not able to buy, their stocks have gone to hell, their currency is broken, they can't get their cash, and whatever discomforts may be coming from this, are they going to, use that narrative to interpret it? I don't get a feeling anybody would tell us if that were true.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of that.
The extent to which that is true.
Right, I've seen a little bit of that coming from, again, it's the right, the alternative extreme right. Sometimes they go and they do harvest a little bit of intellectualism to pepper into their, paranoia. And that idea of, well, what did NATO do? And what has, Biden done, since, there was something about after the Crimean invasion in 2014, that we could have done this stuff then. And the reason we didn't is because it would have, destabilized our election or something for the Democrats. And so when you start to look at this stuff and you're like, okay, now I'm starting to go down to these intellectual trails of actual causes and the players who aren't, in the primary theater, but they're over here doing all this stuff that they're not being pulled into the primary narrative, and there's plenty of players over here, hundreds, maybe thousands. And how do we start to, again, as a rhetorician, pluck these out and go, hey, this guy over here, like oligarchs, it's a category, and yachts. And so we can drop that in with the big carnival arm. And now we can, see it in the political, theater, the way it plays out.
And maybe that's the best we can do. I mean, I don't mean for my questioning of these things or my imagining of what this must be like on the other side of the media coin to in any way, feed that anti-NATO narrative, and it could well be that that's the whole point about war. At some point, when the bullets start flying, you just pick a side. I think it gets back to some of the very basics. Is one, consider that all of the actors are doing this all of the time. And that you have to consider these sources and what their purposes are.
But those are traditional.
And so if this narrative is coming from a right-wing think tank in the United States about Russia or Crimea, you know, you got to connect those dots. You've got to connect those dots to the hard rights love of Russia and realize that that's been going on, that there is a pro-Russian contingent in the United States associated with white nationalists. Be cautious about drawing, you know, conclusions, whatever they may be.
So here, you know, we go back to, you know, Bill Keith's thing on civility and the civic right. tradition and rhetoric of all the things that good rhetoricians, democratic rhetoricians do, check sources, you know, follow the trails, you know, don't take truth at face value, all these things that, again, in the sort of simulacrum, especially right now of war with the digital media, you cannot track all these things. Like, right. what do? Do you pick one little slice and say, I'm going to be the rhetorical expert on this one little slice, and maybe everybody else will panoramic around it until we get a picture? Like, I've seen Ruth Jiat Bean or Ben Jiat is on MSNBC, and she's got a book on authoritarians. And so she's been interviewed a lot about Putin. And she read a thing today on MSNBC about, you know, late stage dictators often get to where they're surrounded by this stuff. They become more and more paranoid as they get older, and they have to act out, and they start to make bad decisions, was essentially her thing. And she used Mussolini as an example, you know, as he, after 20 years in power, he went into Ethiopia, and then he packed up with Hitler. And these are the things that brought him down. And so she's saying this may be happening with Putin. So there's a new narrative now, like Putin is making bad choices versus, you know, Trump popping out and going, Trump's playing 4D chess, and, or, you know, Putin's playing 4D chess and he's savvy and smart. Like, wow, those are two very different narratives.
Right, right. Well, Trump is also an aging crack fart.
Yeah, he wants to support that character.
Yeah, yeah. If I were to pick the panel that would judge who other people are geniuses, Trump and Tucker Carlson would not be on it. So,
but you have seen, like, and I saw this coming through the right, the one that got through the think tanks at the handed down. Like, it's always simple script at the point of delivery. Was, you know, Biden's weak, and that's why if Trump was still in president, they wouldn't have invaded. And that's become Biden's weak. If Trump was president, that's the double-headed, you know, dragon.
Yeah, you got to look at policy here. And if Trump were president, NATO would already be half the way out the door, and maybe Putin wouldn't have had to. Maybe there would have been no gain here. I don't know, but maybe.
But those intellectual strands underneath those big simple claims, nobody in America, you know, is going down into those to do
excavation. This is all based on characterology, absolutely. And if Trump's already, you get back to your hero, victim, villain. If Trump's already your hero, and you go no farther than this in terms of sort of, you know, fact checking.
The right is so good at playing those three angles of the triangle. Like, when Trump wants to play victim, he plays victim hard. When he wants to play hero, he plays it hard. And when he wants to make a villain, he makes a villain hard. And they just move through that triangle. It's just back and forth all the time through that narrative triangle.
Well, yeah. These are the characteristics, as I understand it, of narcissism. You're either the hero or the victim in every story. And anybody that opposes you is the villain. So.
Right, but it's a rhetorical
strategy. It is a perfect system. It is a right. perfect system.
And in the digital world that we talked about, that's super dense, super complicated, you can't really apply rationality to it very well. That triangle of narrativity like that becomes a super strategy. And they just stay with it over and over and over again.
Right. I think this gets back to our classic, you know, propaganda. Just repeat the lie over and over and over and over and over again. Circulate it. And when it seems to be coming from all sides, then it has the, you know, becomes a consensual truth. This is, you know, this is how folklore works. This is, you know, it's just folklore executed through digital media and connection. You know, when McLuhan said we're returning to the global village, this is what villages did, right?
Right. Well, and it's returned to the global village and that idea of orality, because the rationality, the literate kind of investigation of things in order to get down into facts and truth and things like that is no longer tenable. Like it gets attacked by all sides, and it's too dense an environment. So only the simple narrative structures can now be used again and again and again.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, it's that these are events. These are events happening in real time, on your TV and in your cell phone, and on your computer. They have that immediacy about them. You must react to them. You react to them emotionally. You react to them, without critical, you know. So if this were a story that got processed and researched and published in the New York Times about what happened 3 weeks ago in the Ukraine, there's a lot of distance there that imposed by literacy and imposed by the mechanisms of literacy.
Yeah, which require you to be able to have time.
That's
to
not
think.
That's not an event. That's an interior psychological event that you can weigh. But when you're watching a bomb go off and people crying, you don't ask, is this true or false? You know.
Yeah, you react to victim.
One's emotions, and so once again, some of the people are going to be, oh well, this is fake news or whatever. Some people are going to be why can't we do something? So it's kind of how one is directed, I guess, in their responses.
So if we're
governing narratives.
If we're fighting, again, this all comes back to fighting the right for me. You know, if they're using this narrative triangle to gain traction, like they're always trying to gain traction or hold traction. So suddenly Russia is doing something violent, which is generally considered like the evil. Like that's the difference right now to me in these authoritarian regimes. Like even during Black Lives Matter and the protests, rubber bullets don't put bodies on the ground. It's very rare that we got to see bodies on the ground. We got to see it with Kyle Rittenhouse. We got to see a little bit of death here and there. But if the Russians come out and use some type of chemical weapon or thermo weapon or nuclear weapon and mass death, then the entire structure changes, right? There's no way to get out of that villainy.
And we don't have any experiential patterns for how to respond. And I've heard this also sketched as a possible, I don't know whether it's part of the madman narrative, but the strategic Putin could set off a low-level nuke just, I guess, to scramble the eggs here. And how does one deal with that then? What category does that go into? A nuclear assault? Does that go into, you know?
What do you do, though? There's no response to it. We can't respond with nuclear attack.
A long time ago, I spent some time studying the causes of World War One, and 100 years later, people still weren't completely sure what caused World War One, except that there were these systems of alliances, and an event that sparked it. In a way, we're confronting something similar here. It seems to me that we do have these webs of alliance, and the concern here is that somebody, you know, one event or another event is going to set this in motion. And they're pretty upfront, you know. Well, gee, what was that Biden's line yesterday? You have two choices: one, either commit to war with Russia and have World War III, or try to bring them down with these economic sanctions. The funky thing is this, to me right now, as I with my ear to the rail, NATO countries, which are calling themselves European countries, committing weapons, how is that regarded from the other side? And how close to the line does that play?
Right. So if within Russia, they can play their little narrative triangle of like, look what the villains are doing to us. And this is what Putin always tries to do about, I'm justifying my actions because of, you know, your threats to me. Like, you know, I have to preemptively hit the same things that we said, you know, during the Gulf War. We have to preemptively take out Iran, you know, and Iraq, you know, or Iraq because of what's, you know, what's been done to us. Like, we can't let it happen again. And
right.
And so all that preemptive talk is exactly what Putin is saying, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, we hear what he was squeaking about weeks before the invasion about Russia's security concerns. We go, what? NATO is a defensive organization. They're not threatening you. They've never invaded anybody. Once again, I suspect more than a sizable number of people from the other political persuasion in Russia don't see it that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why.
I mean, they might buy the narrative that Putin is spinning, that this is a response to their security concerns. How they can see Ukraine as the source of that, I do not know any more than I ever was able to understand how we saw Iraq as the real actor in 9/11.
Yeah, that was some contortion to get them over.
There's a lot of parallels there,
right?
You know, to me, in terms of the propaganda end of it.
Well, in terms of the modern warfare slotting, and like you're talking about, like alliances, right? That's one of the things that's come out of Vietnam as an explanation, that we got in there because of our alliances, like with France and things like that. And you sort of, again, offload the villainy onto the alliances. You know, it's like, well, we didn't have a choice. No, you always have a choice, you know. So when you look around these things, you know, there's the people trying to find, like you said, you launched into this today with what's the truth going on here? And like, you're trying to figure out the truth of a war that happened over 100 years ago and you still can't do it.
Right. Well, I think once again that war is its own kind of special case of social relations, where truth is sort of given up, you know, I guess once again my position here is to try to understand these messages, their production, the context, and what is not being told, what is being distorted, what are the sources, those kinds of things, right? Just as an instinctive critic. Who does that serve? Maybe, you know, some people have to be doing this, especially as they make policy based on this. And there's certainly people more knowledgeable about, you know, the history of Russian propaganda and Putin's psychomorphology and other things that are probably, you know, more useful than just a clinical rhetorician. But at any rate, I think that's a different kind of position than and I think that's what makes everybody nervous. Ultimately, these things do just erupt as events, and we're compelled to act. Truth doesn't control them.
So. Right. So let's all agree. And I often give people this advice when I'm talking about doing political persuasion / conversion on others. I'm like, well, give up Logos, because that entire channel has one thing. It's been overlaid with skewed Logos, and that's very close to real Logos. It's very hard to do rationality and logic anyway. It's a horrible software for human beings. It breaks instantly when people want to come at it from contentiousness instead of sort of, you know, eking our way through and trying to stay correct right all the way through. So just dump that channel, because you're never going to win there. So if we start with that, hey, it's war, dump the idea of truth. It's not going to function. Maybe later on you can circle back around with some truth and rationality. But for now, let's just jump over to narrativity, you know, and let's look at this war through a narrative lens. And that's why I said, like, starting with this little pyramid of, at least we understand what characters are constantly being in contention And if we're going to win, we've got to make Putin. We can't make the Russian people, apparently, or the Russian soldiers the villain. Like, Putin seems to be the only villain that we have in the entire Russian architecture now. We don't have the Politburo anymore.
That's a good point. And that image of him at one end of the long table with it. We can't even see those other people. They're not even players.
They're not characters, right? They're not.
And even oligarchs are kind of these jovial, rich guys, you know, that.
It would fit perfectly in America. Like, yeah.
That's exactly. Yeah. I've never understood why we call billionaires from Russia oligarchs and America their CEOs.
Well, it's because we don't have robber
owning their own spaceships and stuff.
Yeah, right? Robber barons has already been taken, you know, in our past, and that one died. So
and these are just, you know, amazingly brilliant businessmen here, and they're oligarchs.
It's a good villain turn, though, right? Oligarch. Like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, it kind of works on me, you know. That my first instinct when this kind of was, hey, why aren't we focusing on these guys? Take their money, kick them out. I'm tired of them buying our politicians anyway. Yeah.
Right. So you get, again, like as soon as you hear that word, you've got that whole narrative. We have movies of rich, you know, white corporate guys who have cheated, you know, doing all this stuff. We've got tons of narrative evidence of that and training in that.
Well, I suppose it bespeaks a government that is ruled by this group of people, and that is what they present us, is that basically Putin has, you know, this handful of oligarchs that enable him somehow, that he has control over, or right, whatever.
Yeah,
that is the story that we're getting, is that if Putin were to be replaced, they would be the ones to do it.
So is it ultimately the oligarchs that have the power and let Putin be the front man, or does he have the power and he just has to let these guys kind of, you know, into the party to stay in power?
And those may be two ends of the same egg, that, you know, that they trade off on those narratives depending on how it suits them to do so, right? I don't know.
But in our for us, for the West, as the ones who need to win this, like, what's the story, the best story? We've given up truth. I don't care what an oligarch is. I either need them to be a villain, a hero, or a victim. Nor an outside party. And like I said, the fourth category is an interested outside party involved somehow that we don't understand, but they're, you know, this lurking evil potentially.
Well, I like the story that's emerging, and it's a very hopeful one. That, you know, one aspect of this that occurs to me is that, I mean, the worldwide response here to use these economic sanctions to disassociate from Russian business is unprecedented, and I think that bespeaks a digital economy, a global economy. Sort of is the backside and maybe the saving grace of our financial
sector is going
to
save.
It's never possible to do this before, to shut off Rusky cell phones where they couldn't buy bread, you know? And so there's something.
Money is going to save us.
What's that?
I said, money is going to save us.
Well, it could be. It could be. There is something rather hopeful about the story that this might be enough, and enough at least minimally to chill Putin out, to say, you know, if you go through with a humanitarian disaster at this point in time, you have lost the world. And maybe hopefully he has enough sense about this. And I have to flash back to the Trump years, where it seemed like, you know, on a 2-week basis, he came up with some crazy ass idea and had to be talked down from it, and was always talked down from it, right? this is still possible.
Go back to the movie Network, right? When Ned Beatty is like, there is no nation, this is just corporations. And Trump or Putin has stomped on some corporation toes, apparently, because now the corporations, the money is looking and going, dude, you're playing old world games that we don't play anymore.
Well, BP and Shell Oil have said, we're done with you on the oil front. I mean, and that's that's really all that Russia has going for it these days. It really is a petrostate, and economically, and maybe that is exactly the place to cut it. So that, they are unfortunately historically a petrostate that has nuclear weapons. That was an oversight. Our problem that we were not unable to solve, because if they didn't, you know, I think they would have been wiped off, you know, economically years ago.
In Putin's world, you know, the only thing he's got, the only card he's got is military.
Right. Right. They are still a military superpower, but not an economic one. And I guess where this all started was, I would like to see, you know, this work. I'd like to see sort of just an international protest where we say, look, this is 2022. We do not want these kinds of, you know, wars. That really was the idea after World War II. You know, we said, okay, we fought two world wars. Maybe we shouldn't solve all of our boundary disputes through this kind of activity. We created a UN. And for the most part, we've kept it down to little brush fires. That's why people keep, you know, saying this is the biggest, you know, military crisis since World War II.
Right.
In Europe, at least.
Well, and again, like I'm forcing this to stay in the narrative frame.
Sure.
So you've basically outlined a new plot.
But that's a good story. That is a good story.
That is an awesome story, because less people die in that story. And we win. Right? We have the money.
Right.
We're going to win that story, that plot.
Yeah, and I think I think what people are scrambling around under the covers here to do is to sort of say, can we come up with a story where Putin doesn't really lose? Because that's the more likely. That's the more likely one that saves a lot of lives.
Right.
So maybe we just need a lot of creativity in the rhetorical resources of Moscow right now.
Sure.
And I personally would help fly you over.
So if we establish, hey, we want this to be the plot of this movie. We don't want the plot to go into physical destruction and murder in order for Putin to stay in power and threaten the world with his nukes. We want a financial plot. Well, what is the act three here then? Like, how does he win financially in the financial world? Is it by staying in power of an entire country? Or are we like, hey, we'll let you keep your $200 billion, go live wherever you want, and just go?
Yeah, you know, once again, I think that offer has to come from somebody somebody over there, but that's...
I don't know, like
retire. Early retirement.
Hey, we're the rhetorical screenwriters right now. Let's write the act three. Like, this is how you solve it. So this is why Putin's characterology, you know, is he crazy? Is he power mad? Is he paranoid? Because you can't let that guy, there's no way for that guy to win. You can offer him financial win and it's not going to mean anything to him. Power is the only win. Right.
Or is he an aging guy? He's 69. He's been in power quite a while. He's kind of spinning his wheels, the model that he's operating on. Sort of people sort of saying, well, you know, you've had this grand vision of marking history with the, you know, the reunite, you know, time to get busy here.
Well, I've seen, and I wrote about this very early, like, and you've seen a lot of it now, like they're pulling up the past failed authoritarians and putting Putin into that storyline. Hey, you want to be Mussolini hanging up by your ankles from a gas station? Do you want to die in a bunker by yourself? You know, because you're going in that direction. You know,
I like the ad. This doesn't end well, right? Just a flash on these previous narratives, right?
Yeah.
Hitler in the bunker, Mussolini on the rope, you know, just these things don't end well.
Right. And so, like, is that, like, if we're going to persuade Putin, you know, with some type of, if he's still rational and we can still get in there and even do some narrativity with him, if you make those things clean enough, it's like, well, that's not the way I want to end. Or is he already resigned to, I'm not going to end well if I give up at all? hasn't done any really war crimes yet, right? He wouldn't be put in jail yet.
Well, they're claiming them, but it's, you know, that's always claimed. War is itself a crime.
Right.
And, yeah, you know, the other narrative that they've sunk into us in the last week or so is and one that I, you know, personally, because I'm not a Russia watcher or whatever, not in international politics that much, but that this, you know, the reason why Putin's doing this is because he's done this five times before and won every time. And so now there's a lot of parallels to, well, gee, if what happens next is what happened to Chechnya, you know, he's going to level it. So, you know, in a way, they've got to counter that disposition and say, you know, the world has, you know, you got to buy, the world has changed here, and you do not want to be remembered as the guy who, you know, murdered all these people. and maybe that will work.
Yeah. Well, again, like now we're
playing. He hasn't paid the price for that yet.
Well, I think it's interesting now that we're playing, like, if we had access to Putin and we're playing narrative games with, you know, Vladimir Putin to get him to change his plan here. Like you said, he's played this plot before, and this particular, you know, angle in the game of Risk has worked for him very well.
You know, that's interesting you said that. I was just thinking about the game of Risk and how it fought World War II, basically, on the globe. You know, you put, stack your armies here, you start seeing why some things happened as they did. How would you do this as a narrative game, as in your own language? You know, you have a stack of victim cards, a stack of hero cards, a stack of villain cards, what would this symbolic logomachy, which means the war of words, how would this translate into a Risk kind of model, where one could sort of see, gee, there's only so many narrative outcomes here. Because once again, that's kind of where we're at today, Ukraine is clearly winning the information war. And information is quite a euphemism in that, right? What [S2] Yep. [S1] We would call the rhetoric war. And clearly, Biden and the Europeans are sort of announcing themselves in ways that has lain fallow for over a decade. And democracy is getting a kind of a symbolic jolt in the arm. So,
yeah, we've got a hero again in democracy. Like, I don't think Biden can quite ascend a hero because he is so old and he's got so much, you know.
But maybe that is the improvement. Maybe it's not about one individual guy and his swagger. I mean, that's really the only complaint that the retros in America have about Biden. You know, it's no swagger. But look at the leadership that's come forward in Europe. Maybe all we need is somebody who's reasonable and not, you know, Trump. That was what we elected Biden to be, is not Trump.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
and it doesn't have the full, you know, hero, again, the sort of traditional hero of young, virile, strong, stand up, kill off the villain, you know. That's the role of the hero always, is right, directly murdering the villain in an intense,
and George slaying the dragon,
visceral way. I don't think Biden's going to do that, but you're starting to see some of the alternative hero structures come up around Biden, that he's this ultimate behind the scenes player, you know, and he's so good at this because of all his experience, he's getting all these things done by other people. So we can step back, because we become a villain very quickly for much of the world because of things like, yeah, we're going to lead a coalition into, you know, Kuwait, and we're not going to stop there, you know. It's like, well,
but in the bigger picture, for this to shift from, you know, massive bloodletting, war of all against all, you know, nuclear disaster, whatever these kinds of more science fiction, traditional World War II born outcomes are in terms of fantasy, for this to shift to a sheer economic thing. War is terrible economics. It is not profitable.
For some people, it is.
For some people, But, you know, there's the interdependence born of kind of our current economic relations and the progress that the world's made. You know, killing and bloodletting among really poor people, right? These are people who don't have anything to lose. Maybe what we're discovering is we have succeeded in this world of giving these people something to lose. And attaching a price to it. So it would be a symbolic masterpiece for this to be able to shift in that direction.
Well, I think laying that out for people so they can see what direction it should shift into is one of the things that these super
active. Well, it's just that we have no other hope, because once again, every other path that we've chosen here in this conversation leads back to the failure of peace and you know, the outcomes of war. So, and that is what I think the world is quite nervous about on this day as we talk.
Well, and I, you know,
as the kind of John Lennon moment. Let's give peace a chance here, folks.
I always want to make rhetoric do way more, you know, than it currently is. I hate it.
But that is once again, we talked about the 20th century rebirth of rhetoric in the context of this kind of massive changing, developing techno society, and the strife that attended all of it. And that is what it's right. That is the humane ideal of it, which is if we can fight these wars through words, we don't have to do it through blood. So we can only get a little bit better. And part of that getting better is to step back and to recognize, the nature of Babel itself, that cooperation is difficult. And the resources of cooperation, you know, can be seriously damaged or made toxic. And their failure results in things like, oh, well, let's unify by just all hating the same person or the same group of people. And that's part of the failure right now. I think that the Russians and Ukrainians are so similar that, you know, I don't think they really want to kill each other that badly. That seems to be one of the reports, at least. So anyway, I don't know.
Yeah, it is. Again, my goal with all this stuff is always to force rhetoric to super activate and to be used in proactive ways. So it's not just studying after the fact of, oh, here's all the rhetorical things that happened. But I think what the right has done is grabbed rhetoric, I would call immoral, you know, unethical structures, and they use them proactively.
But those are the least common denominator historical ones, right? Those are the old things that work. That's why, it is a failure of creativity.
Exactly.
And our goal would be to get people sufficiently free of those kinds of structures, but you've got to invent new ones. Because once again, when it's crisis, we always choose the worn path.
Sure.
And so somewhere, somehow, somebody's got to find a new path. And, you know,
well, that's
and
why
so,
I got you. That's why I have you on here. You're supposed to.
There you go. Well, but I can make Biden that hero to sort of say, you know, I could have come out and beat my chest and shot off rockets. There's no doubt about it. Somebody could have sent, you know, a squadron of fighters and blown the shit out of that convoy. But the consequences are horrendous. And so to be mindful of that and to not want to reap those hero chips, but to sort of say, let's try this, you know, is a new form.
Yeah, well, that is a rhetorical hero, right? Diplomatic channels, doing things with words, doing things with agreements versus violence. Like Biden really in some ways is a rhetorical hero.
I agree. And, you know, he's getting some of that cred from some of the commentary, at least. I don't know that that commentary will go to the right kinds of people that would need to hear it. But maybe, you know, given his popularity, maybe almost everybody needs to hear it, which is, you know, this leadership thing is not just about one guy making one-liners and smart-ass remarks. It's about coming up with a team of knowledgeable people to deal with complex problems. On the same day we have a war breaking out in Chechnya, Ukraine, we've got a UN report saying, man, the climate change thing is really pretty serious. And that's a euphemistic rendering of it. We really don't need a conventional war where people are shooting off gunpowder.
I like the rhetorician as hero.
There you go.
It's a category that has not been fully explored.
We don't have Hollywood. too many movies where the rhetorician saves the day.
No, not too many. Although when you see in A Few Good Men, do you remember A Few Good Men with Tom Cruise? Basically, went to the nuclear rhetorical option of confronting Nicholson, with words, with truth, yeah, with challenge. That was just a rhetorical choice. And it got the villain into a different mode. And so he really did win that with rhetoric.
What I thought about really was the old 50s and early 60s sci-fi movies where it's the journalist. Right. something along these lines.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, even in Game of Thrones, it was the guy who, studied the books.
Sure.
Who found the answer. And then all the active guys had to go out and use the answer, but he was at least partially a hero.
Yeah, but in the end, it was the dragons, right? The dragons and the dead people.
Hard to beat that narrative.
The army of primitives that marched with the dragons.
This was super fun. I think we ought to do it again next week. As the war progresses, we'll just keep...
We'll check back in and see how these narratives are going now that we've sort of given them names and we can track them on the game board a little bit. If nothing else, I think that's right. I mean, we are hearing those story seeds, to coin a phrase from another scholar, being planted, I think. And somewhere somebody's got to put some serious water and fertilizer on one that works.
As a screenwriter and a rhetorician and somebody who does story, and I like the idea that we can think about this, plot out a new, create a new plot, and then try to drive that into the world in a vivid way so it has some effect.
Okay.
I like it. All right. So
thanks, Dan.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it once again. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Now from Manhattan Beach, California, which is why it's such a weird kind of, I got this weird red glow and everything from these lights. We'll keep working on the production and we'll keep working on the war. I don't want to just be clinical rhetoricians. We have to be involved somehow. So check back and we'll talk about this again. See ya. Sure.